Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm Craig Cervillo, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Matthew Miller about his excellent new book, The German Epic in the Cold War. Dr. Miller, hello, and welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Dr. Miller, we'd like to begin these chats with having the author tell us a little bit about themselves.
Sure. I grew up in Pennsylvania and learned German mostly as a high school exchange student, where as a teenager, I spent a year in the eastern part of Germany shortly after unification. I was there in 1992 to 93. It was a pretty exciting time, and that experience sparked a longstanding interest in the cultural, political, and literary history of German-speaking Europe, which I then pursued in my studies, both at the undergraduate and graduate levels. I did my graduate degree at Columbia University in New York City, worked primarily with Andreas Hussen there, as well as others like Harold Müller and Lydia Gurr in the philosophy department. And now I'm located in central New York at Colgate University, which is a small college where I teach German and European studies, and I've been here for about 10 years.
Is this your first book?
Yes, it's the first book that I've authored. I have a previous book that I co-edited on the Danube River. Came out a couple years ago, but this is the first book that I wrote myself.
Let's turn to this book. So how did you come up with the topic for this book?
Right. So I mentioned my graduate work at Columbia University. There, I focused mostly on 20th century German literary studies, as well as aesthetics and critical theory and political history. And it's in that context that I first read works by Peter Weiss, Uwe Jonsson, and Alexander Kluge with great interest. Those are the three authors I focus on in the book. But at the time, I didn't quite have the wherewithal, let's say, to fully come to terms with their respective projects. So having completed graduate school and completed a dissertation on Kluge in conjunction with the works of the East German playwright Heiner Müller, I was left with a kind of unyielding thirst and desire and interest to delve deeper into the exciting terrain of some of the most ambitious works of German language literature from the second half of the 20th century. So the three I address in my book are Weiss's The Aesthetics of Resistance, Uwe Jonsson's Anniversaries from a Year in the Life of Gesine Crespo, that's the name of his main character, and then Alexander Kluge's Chronicle of Feelings, which Kluge published in 2000 as a collection of all of his previously published literary writings. He started writing in the early 60s and then included a lot of stories that he wrote after the what the Germans call the Wende, the transition or the political process that led to the unification of East and West Germany in 1990.
So in your book title, you have the subtitle is the Cold War Epic. Can you describe to us what you mean by that? Maybe we'll start with, actually, let's start with something more basic. What is an epic?
Yeah, well, it's a great question and an important question, one to highlight in a couple of different ways. In German, there is a very in German literary studies, I should say, there's a very general distinction, kind of tripartite distinction between epic works, dramatic works, and lyrical works. So that just serves as a way to separate prose writings from theatrical writings and from poetry, on the other hand. But the term that we're more familiar, many of us in the U.S. or North America are familiar with the term as an ancient genre of literature. So many undergraduate students come into contact with epics when we're required to read Homer, which they do for good reason. And very generally speaking, one can note a kind of divide between antiquity and modernity with regard to the genre of epic. So in modernity, one can say the ancient epic, the things like the Odyssey and the Iliad of Homer, basically become the novel, right? Which is a different genre and is seemingly more suited to a modern age of social fragmentation, individualization, transcendental homelessness, and all these problems that modernity brings about. And we still speak, interestingly enough, about epic novels. And in fact, some of the authors that that I discuss in my book also describe their works as novels. But I actually epic novel, of course, refers usually to a novel that's very long, right? And and with the epic, there's definitely a question of scope that's important. But I tried to use chapter one in my book to advance additional distinctions between the genre of the novel and that of that modern epic in order to give readers things to hold on to. And I can walk through some of those if you like.
That would be helpful if you could give us a little context as to what the difference is.
Sure. So the one distinction that I think is important is the collective dimensions of epic versus the individual or individualistic dimensions of the modern novel. So in a very influential definition that I cite in my book by the German philosopher Hegel, he underscores the ancient epic's task to kind of narrate the story of a whole people or a whole epoch. And one sees that, one sees how he derives his definition very, very quickly from thinking about things like Homer's works. In the modern epic, that epic genre under the conditions of modernity, there are no longer these whole or self-contained entities that seem to lend themselves to such narration. Rather, the modern epic that I describe is situated at the kind of fissures of a world disorder, and that has to do with the situation in the Cold War that I'll speak a little bit more about. But I just to highlight the other part of it. So if the epic is more oriented towards collective experiences, the novel has been described as more individualized, and I cite relevant literary theorists who talk about this. But what I'm interested in showing is how the modern epic is actually capable and keen on moving beyond individualism and individual categories of like the self-contained subject in order to narrate larger aspects of society and how it works. And so the Cold War epic specifically situates itself at these fissures between the first and second worlds, between the Western capitalist world and the Eastern socialist world, and moves outward from there to kind of tell stories about an entire world condition, let's say. It usually fails to do that, right? There's a great aspiration to tell the whole tale of modernity, but that, of course, is too gargantuan a task for any single work of literature to do. The point that I try to underscore is that there is an orientation towards what literary theorists have described as totality. There's an orientation to try to tell the whole tale or as much as possible about one's given situation as possible. And that gives rise to a kind of innovative realism that I discuss in the book.
If someone were to ask you why the epic is an important element of study or important thing to study, what would you tell them?
I would point to the features that I highlight in the book, such as this aspiration to map society in creative ways, that these techniques serve both to locate an individual or a community's place in a complex world, and then direct literature to fathoming, along with philosophical and scientific discourses, the different ways in which society works and challenges people. So that's a key feature, I think, of epic that I highlight throughout. And then another key feature, or there are a couple more actually I'd like to mention. One, there's a kind of historicizing imperative. So one of the questions that I worked on in writing the book was, well, why does epic emerge at certain points, right? And I found there that in the context that I'm talking about, the 1945 constitutes really a rupture in civilization, or to put it more generally, I think that fascism itself or the Nazi terror constitute kind of ruptures in civilization that have to be dealt with in various ways. And so for all three writers in different ways, 1945 really constitutes a historical watershed, a moment of a kind of like of a before and after that one has to come to terms with, right? And so what each of them does in his own way is to step back from the present, try to reset the imagination under conditions of great duress, and figure out how literature might emerge anew to tell stories about the horrors that the Nazi terror subjected much of Europe and other parts of the world to. So that's an important part. They do this in very different ways. One thing we can talk about perhaps are the different media techniques that they use. So there's a kind of medial plurality going on in the modern epic. There are multimedial techniques. Each epic sets itself in relation to other forms of non-literary discourse, which it grapples with and which it sometimes relies on. And then another thing is that the epics also, they want to teach. There's a kind of educational impulse to the modern epic, at least in the way that these three writers deal with it. And they set up scenarios of learning that are both very instructive, but also wonderfully pleasurable. And so that's something else that I tease out of their works across the different chapters of the book.
Yeah, I definitely want to get back to the different media, particularly with Klug. But before we get there, Will, I want to talk about the authors individually, but sure. I do want to follow up on something you said about 45 being sort of a watershed, you know, date.
Yeah.
Just very quickly, when were all three of these individuals born? What years?
So Weiss is the oldest of the three. He was born in 1916. Kluge and Jonsson were born around 1930, but they all started writing shortly after the construction of the Berlin Wall, it's fair to say. And the construction of the Berlin Wall in 1961 kind of is a marker that begins the second period of the Cold War, let's say, which seems to freeze this situation of geopolitical opposition between the blocs, between the capitalist U.S. and Western Europe and the Soviet Union in the East, that looks like a kind of stalemate that continued for a long period of time. And each of the authors starts writing and working in that situation. But they're doing two things. Each of the epics does, they have kind of two, there are two main points of orientation in each of the epics. The one point of the orientation is involves the task of coming to terms with World War II and the Holocaust and Germany's responsibility for genocide, right? And the second orientation is to the present, right? Living in the shadows of World War, living amidst the Cold War, which is a divided, where Germany is divided, where Europe is divided, where the globe is divided between these different political and ideological systems. And on the one hand, that situation, that's a very kind of overwhelming and complex situation. On the other hand, the primacy of political and economic constellations made it perhaps easier than today to pinpoint different pinpoint the positions of individuals, their political options, their kind of cultural imaginaries, and so on. And so, the Cold War context impacts each work very starkly.
Yeah, the reason I asked about their birth dates is I was curious as to how each one of them experienced fascism.
Yes,
I think, I mean, as we'll continue to talk about, the Cold War is obviously extremely important in each of their experiences. But Weiss must have had a much more complete experience with fascism. The other two were born in the 30s, so they were children.
Right. Exactly.
So can you give us a little compare and contrast of how that might have impacted Weiss as opposed to the other two, or how they experienced Nazism impacted what they did later?
Yes, absolutely. It's very important because it's very interesting. Peter Weiss liked to highlight the fact that he was never actually German. His father was born in Austria-Hungary, and later on his father had Czechoslovakian citizenship. And Weiss, and his father was also of a Jewish background, and so Weiss, with his family, went into exile in the 30s. I think Weiss reached Sweden in 1939 before the war began. And as a young person, and his parents had also been forced to relocate there, and so he resided in Stockholm, which he considered his place of exile and then home in a sense until his passing there in 1982. So for these reasons, Weiss's work is much more heavily impacted by the biographical experience of fascism. And it's of course interesting that his main book, The Aesthetics of Resistance, is really focused on writing or it's focused on kind of the unwritten story of international resistance to German and European fascisms. And so, and we can talk about that more, but that the impact, the biographical impact of fascism is much more present in Weiss's work, although must be underscored curiously. It's Jonsson's Anniversaries, which deals much more explicitly and intensively with Germany's culpability for the Holocaust than Weiss. Weiss actually focuses more on the politics of the anti-fascist resistance rather than the suffering of European Jews, although that is also, of course, an important element in his Aesthetics of Resistance.
Do any of the authors have sort of family firsthand experience with sort of the horrors of fascism? Did they have relatives in concentration camps, or did they participate? Did any relatives participate or collaborate, I guess?
For the second question, the short answer is no. Weiss's family were of course displaced. I don't know off the top of my head. I'm sure there were family members who were persecuted. Kluge and Jonsson's situation was, as a young person, he ended up migrating westward. So he was born in Pomerania, which was then part of Germany, now part of Poland. He migrated westwards with his mother to Mecklenburg, where Jahrestage, the anniversaries, is also set. His father was forced to serve in the military, but none of them were collaborators. None of the immediate family members were collaborators in any other sense, to my knowledge.
Yeah, and sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot. Like, do you have their whole family tree in front of you?
An important question, though, because each author, regardless of whether their immediate family members were involved, they nonetheless pose questions about Germany's general involvement, right? And so their characters, so for example, Gesine Crespo, the unforgettable main character of Anniversaries in Jonsson's work, tells the whole story of her family in the fictional setting of Jericho in Mecklenburg in northeastern Germany, and basically walks through the various culpabilities or attempts of resisting the Nazis and so on, by telling the story of her family. And the fact that that story is by itself fictional, but of course it's based on actual historical experiences that various people had. And so that's really, Anniversaries is really the best work to look at for people interested in life under fascism from a literary perspective. And I don't want to fail to mention that the entire epic, which in the German edition is about 1,900 pages long, has now been translated into English by Damien Searles. It was published last year, I think, or maybe the year before, Anniversaries. And so it's available to readers of English also. It's a very exciting feat and an impressive accomplishment, I will say.
So let's now focus in on each of the authors and chapters individually. Sure. Let's start with Weiss. You gave some of his biographical details. Mm-hmm. Already. So unless there's anything else you want to include there, we can move on to the specifics about his work.
Well, I did, maybe just for Weiss's biography, I think it's important. So I mentioned 1945 as the caesura of political time that's important for each author. For Weiss and Jonsson, 1968 is also a big and important year. Jonsson's work, of course, is set in 1968. 1968 is also this kind of signifier of the possibility, or maybe one of the possibilities of larger social change, both in the East and in the West. And 1968 was an important year for Weiss, who stepped out of the disappointments of the student protest movements and so on, and the suppression of the Prague Spring, which we'll probably talk about as one of the last important reform movements within the socialist age. Weiss stepped out of those experiences and wrote The Aesthetics of Resistance, also to process disappointments about the prospects of political change. And so that was important. Right before that, he had written two plays that I want to mention, that with which listeners may be more familiar. One is The Investigation, Die Ermittlung, which is based on the Auschwitz trials in Frankfurt that Weiss attended. And then another play is the Marassade play, which also became internationally well known. I just wanted to fill those pieces in about Weiss's biography, but I'm happy to turn to the specifics of the Aesthetics of Resistance with you.
Yeah, can I ask you a question about the play? You said he attended the Auschwitz trial.
Yes.
Why did he feel the need to do? Was it research because he knew he was going to write a play, or was this just?
I think it was part of his just. I mean, each of the writers were always, they had an insatiable thirst for knowledge about what was going on and about how Germany how the prosecution of the war crimes and crimes against humanity perpetuated by Nazi Germany would be dealt with. And so there was a personal interest in that Weiss had, very much as somebody whose family was displaced because of their Jewish identity. Was keen on attending and did so. And I don't know that if he knew for sure that he would write a play coming out of that, but his play, The Investigation, is very documentary, very specifically based on his attendance of those trials. And he changed the material, he organized the material in order to turn it into a play that could be performed within, 2 hours or so, but it was a very important moment where a very important contribution to the kind of public debate about German responsibility that had up to that time not been front and center in the kind of public sphere of the country of West Germany, or in East Germany is a little bit of a different case, but it's interesting that the investigation was performed simultaneously in East and West Germany when it premiered in 65, I think.
Yeah. Okay. So sorry, I took a little aside there.
Okay.
The major work of his that you focus on in this book is about anti-fascist resistance.
Yes.
explain to us why he chose that as mm-hmm. is the topic, and then I'll ask you some stuff.
Yeah. So there's a sense, and this is also maybe a little bit biographical as well. There's a sense that Weiss had, I think it's fair to say, and I don't mean this in a bad way, that he himself missed, as it were, the opportunity to do more against the Nazi terror than he was able to, or that he could. At the time, he would have been in his, he would have turned 20 in 1936, to give you an idea. And he said, one thing he said is that he wrote this story to document what he earlier had not been able to see or to be a part of. And so, while it's a fictional story, it's also based strongly on historical facts. And two main problems that he deals with in the work, or two main motivations, is to work through the historical weakness of the left's, the political left's opposition to Nazism, a weakness that in part stemmed from the fact that it was not entirely unified between communists and social democrats and other kinds of democrats and whatnot. And so one of the, he focuses a lot at the beginning in the first volume of the three-volume work on the Spanish Civil War and the failed attempt to save the Republic. And then another main historical problem, of course, that he's dealing is with the kind of Stalinist deformation of the left through the rise of the Soviet Union and its kind of takeover of the Third International. And so those are some of the main historical problems that he's working through. But I try to show that his story, the tale he tells about the anti-fascist resistance, is of a greater and more general significance. And it might be helpful in this context. I mean, we of course, you know, in the 21st century, there's been a lot of discussion and debate about the rise of authoritarian politics, of anti-democratic politics, and a rise that has compelled people to return to thinking about what fascism is. And we can get into that more if you like. But I like to point to Weiss's work or the significance thereof by referring to a passage by Primo Levi, who was a Holocaust survivor who wrote about each age having its own fascism, and who wrote about a fascism, the warning signs of which we see whenever the concentration of power denies citizens the possibility and the means of expressing themselves. And Weiss's attempt to basically reestablish the ability to express things, to remake the German language, which is a language of the perpetrators, into a language that could reveal, critique, and rehumanize the world in the wake of fascism becomes an important impetus of his epic.
Where would Weiss be on the political spectrum? You mentioned his obviously he disdained fascism and mm-hmm. bemoaned the sort of the left's inability to unify but then you also mentioned he wasn't a fan of Stalin.
Right. Right.
So where would he be?
He, in the 60s, he publicly declared his solidarity with the socialist cause, but he retained a very tense relationship with actually existing states, such as East Germany. He visited East Germany many times. He worked with artists there, especially theater makers who were involved in staging his plays in East Germany and so on. And there's a definite commitment on Weiss's part to working through the discourse and imagination, really, of Marxism to see if Marxist discourse still offered or to basically identify the resources of Marxist discourse to bolster the prospects of human emancipation, whatever context they find themselves in. But he remained in Sweden throughout his life, and there's a way in which the work, The Aesthetics of Resistance, deals with the politics of the left. But what is more interesting as I try to argue in different places, what's more interesting than pinpointing Weiss's politics is to see how the work of literature, how Aesthetics of Resistance operates as a work of literature, which involves politics but does not dictate politics. And that can be a very fun and revealing and rewarding experience, I think, for readers to see, given this general threat of dehumanization, what kinds of things we can do to respond to that and to ensure that we are still living lives of quality and of social responsibility.
Does he give a prescription for that in the book?
There's no prescription, but there are different modes and scenes. So one of the main ways he does that is by interacting, by incorporating many works of art into the narrative. And so one thing he does towards the end of the Spanish Civil War, he has his narrators discuss things like Picasso's Guernica, all right, where Weiss speaks about, has his narrator speak about Guernica in that context, or about Picasso rather, as someone who equated the struggle for truth in art with rebellion against demagoguery, right? And so it's a good example of the ways in which works of art are activated in the epic, both for clarifying people's political situations and thoughts about what they've, or the kinds of experiences that they've undergone, but also to re-motivate people to continue to attempt to resist and to articulate their yearnings and aspirations in ways that don't grant the demagogues the upper hand or the final word.
So let's wrap up Weiss.
Okay.
And turn to Johnson. Johnson, as you mentioned, a little younger. His book sort of specifically looks at certain themes, German division and experiences with exile. But let's start with his biographical information. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself.
Sure, that's fine. The as I mentioned earlier, I think he was born in Pomerania, which is part of Germany prior to the end of the war. Became part of Poland once the borders shifted. He moved westwards to Mecklenburg, which was in the GDR. He grew up in the GDR. His aspirations to become a writer, however, were met with difficulty in East Germany. And he famously described his emigration from East Germany to West Berlin in 1959 as a relocation. I'm moving to Berlin, he said, with which West Berlin was meant. And the part of the reason for that is that he could only publish his works, such as the first challenging modernist novel, Speculations About Jacob. He could only publish them in the West because they were far, the socialist regime in East Germany regarded them as far too critical or deviant in one way or another. And so he didn't stay in West Berlin for very long. He actually traveled onward to the United States, which he first visited in the early 60s. He lived in Italy for a time, spent a couple of years working in New York City, and then eventually settled in England, in a town called Sheerness on the Sea, where he died in 1984. Prior to his passing, he was able to complete the fourth and last volume of his epic Anniversaries, which is a wondrous work detailing the fictional life of this Gesine Crespo that I mentioned. And it does so across an entire year, 1967 to 1968. He actually begins on around August 20th, 1967, to end on August 20th, 1968, which I mentioned is a super important date because it's on the eve of the Soviet suppression of the Prague Spring, which is where Gesine, his main character, is headed at the end of the story. So it ends very kind of ominously in that way.
Can you give obviously the choice of year for him is no mistake. Can you right. give the listeners some background as to why that is?
It's a very tumultuous year. It is a year, 1967-68 is a year of great turmoil all over the globe. It's interesting. For readers in the U.S., it'll be super interesting to look at Anniversaries because it's set in New York City. And Johnson pays a lot of attention to all of the social strife that is going on in New York City and the country at that time. He works a lot with the New York Times, a newspaper that is integrated into the epic as a kind of another resource of its narration, let's say. And he deals a lot of, or he tracks kind of both the violence in the U.S. at the time as a domestic challenge, and details the escapades of the U.S. military in Vietnam and the protests against the war at that time. Elsewhere, Prague is a focus for Johnson because it is in Prague at this time that the Czechoslovak Socialist Party is seeking to liberalize society and seeking to make socialism more democratic, or to outfit it with a so-called human face, as the phrase went at the time. And that was very interesting because to Jonsson also, I think, of course, to his character as well, because of their Gesine, who is herself an emigre of East Germany, is still interested in the socialist project as an idea, but of course has suffered from its dictatorial deformations across the history of her life. And so the sign that in Prague or in the Czechoslovak Republic that socialism could be made more humane again and be made more democratic again and could be actually brought in line with the interests and needs of human beings and citizens was super exciting. And so the anniversaries really derives a lot of its force from its exploration of the attempt to make a better socialism, I guess, to put a better socialism into the world, let's say.
Was Jonsson sort of demoralized after 68 and how it turned out?
Yes, I think so. I think it's fair to say. He was always a very private person and kind of reclusive, although I had the opportunity to peruse his library and his posthumous papers in Rostock, where they're housed on a research visit there. It's super exciting because you see how much he actually followed other writers and followed the kind of history of the times in such detail. And so he had Weiss's works and Kluge's works in his library with notes, you know, written in the text that I of course read with great interest. But he became reclusive and retired, retreated, let's rather, to that small town in England in order to complete the epic, but did not have a tremendous amount of interaction with others during that time. It's actually very sad that he was found dead in his apartment there after being missed for several days. And so it's kind of a melancholic end to his life. And some people have described the anniversaries in terms of this melancholy, but I actually try to tease out the ways in which it's quite a hopeful and interesting work that remains, that has something a lot to say about the prospects of political practice and social emancipation, even though the story that it invests, the history that it invests in so much was suppressed by the Soviets. So it's not, the problem is, for Gesine, the problem is that the Prague Spring gets put down, but the book abounds in such an interesting progressive imagination that you can go back through and read about the Jonsson's mediation of New York City life and his interrogation of socialist practices and actually come away with a greater understanding of the possible resources of an emancipatory politics.
Let me ask you, sort of for comparison's sake, how did the other two handle 1968? How did they see it sort of in terms of its historical importance, and how do they deal with the disappointment of sort of its failures?
Yeah, so it's present in all three of their works, most so in Jonsson's. Kluge has a lot of stories about 68 as well. I would argue, though, that he tends to take a more ironic and kind of removed approach to the prospects of social transformation at that time. And that's one of the strange conundrums about Kluge's work, which seems, on the one hand, it seems equally invested in the kind of emancipatory politics that one can ascribe to Weiss and Jonsson, but it is hard to see harder to see, I think, in Kluge how it would translate into kind of political practice.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, Turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Johnson also, he sort of seems to think a lot about the division of Germany.
Yes.
Right? Why, I mean, he wasn't living there. Why was this such an important thing for him to think about?
I think for him especially, but also for Weiss in a different way, less so for Kluge perhaps. For Janssen, it's really about the loss of a home and having forced to, I mean, on the one hand, as a young person, of course, he's forced to migrate westward, as I mentioned. He's essentially finds himself forced to leave the GDR, even though he would have preferred to have remained in East Germany. And I think that is an experience that he was never able to forget or overcome. And in fact, it plays a large role in Gesine's story, because Gesine says, for example, she's narrating the story of her family to her daughter Marie, and says, at one point she says, Where I am from no longer exists, and therefore we don't have a home, right, is the thing to be extrapolated from it. And ever since emigrating, she is looking for a home and cannot find one. And New York is for her and her daughter, she says, only an imagined home. She resides there, but it never comes to be a home in this more emphatic, emotionally important sense. Towards the end of the novel, her identification with Reform Socialism as Prague is figures as a possible home. But in general, I think the experience of exile in Weiss and Janssen renders this question of how to have a home, or where to have a home, or what are the conditions of belonging to a home, super important. And that, of course, is a big issue the epic deals with, that remains with us in our times, and is something that definitely distinguishes the modern epic, or rather the post-catastrophic epic of these authors, from the ancient epic of yore, which is really about establishing, through a nationalizing narrative, a kind of home and collective to which one belongs. Janssen and Weiss's characters don't easily find the homes and collectives to which they wish to belong.
Yeah, it seems obvious, but I just want to, you know, sort of highlight that their personal experiences, their life experiences, really do shape what they're writing about. And
absolutely.
And I think it's just important that we, you know, of course they're going to, you know, Janssen wants to talk about exile and division because he's been driven from his home. And
and it's super interesting, if I may just follow up to that. Sure. I mean, it's super interesting because both Weiss's narrator and Janssen's character, Gesine Crespel, have been discussed as kind of alter egos of the writers, and sometimes even criticized for that. But it's important, for anyone interested in reading these books, it's super important because by crafting these fictional stories about such people who are related to themselves but ultimately different and distinct and not real, right? They are able to process the hardships which they themselves have suffered. And I think that's one of the hopeful things about these epics, which really they abound in the narration of catastrophe and suffering and genocide and death, and yet they are so optimistic and hopeful and do not yield. They nowhere yield in their kind of hopefulness for better living and a better age and a better time. And I think that's really something, especially now, you know, with the things we're currently facing, I think is something to be to hold on to in terms of what literature can do in terms of offering both consolation, but also a sense of a future that is distinct from the present. However bleak the present appears, there can be a qualitatively different future.
So let's shift gears now and let's talk, make sure we get, give Kluge equal time, particularly for his biography and his work. So let's start with the same pattern. Give us some biographical background on him.
Sure. Kluge grew up in the town of Halberstadt, which is located, it's in the state called Sachsen-Anhalt of Germany, which was also part of East Germany after the war. Halberstadt was bombed heavily by the American Air Force near the end of the war, and Kluge ended up migrating with his mother as a young person to Berlin, where he completed his high school in West Berlin, and then after that went on to study in West Germany, in Marburg, and then in Frankfurt. I mentioned Frankfurt because that's of course where the Frankfurt School is located, Institute for Social Research, which was reconstituted after the war. Theodor Adorno and Max Horkheimer go back there after their exile in the U.S. go back to reconstitute the institute. And Kluge met them and worked with them in the 60s, and can be really regarded as a kind of as someone who continues the tradition of critical theory in the specific sense of the Frankfurt School's work. I mentioned Halberstadt, his hometown, also because one of his most memorable story complexes is the air raid on Halberstadt, so which is included in the Chronicle of Feelings that I discuss, and it's also been translated, so it's accessible in English to listeners if they're interested. I really recommend it because it's a super fascinating but also very unusual way of narrating the story about the bombing of one's hometown. And that absolutely for Kluge also is a traumatic loss akin to the loss of home that we talked about in Weiss and Janssen, that he deals with by creating, I call it a story complex. It creates basically a multimedial narrative about that bombing in order to process what happened and in order to show what literature can, but also kind of has to do in order to tell a story about something that is cannot be readily or easily captured by just speaking about it.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about Kluge, he seems to embrace different forms of sort of visual media in his work.
Yes.
And that struck me as different than the other two. Not that the other two were devoid of it entirely, but he seemed to more fully embrace it. Tell us why, and then sort of what certain media was he using? What was he looking for?
Yes, absolutely. It's a great question because my argument on a general level, my argument about the modern epic is that it deals extensively with other media of society, and that is necessary. Literature is obviously not a self. Literature is one medial discourse among many others. It is no longer a leading one. Weiss, Janssen, and Kluge all know this. Weiss and Janssen, however, basically they compose their epics in such a way that one comes away with the sense it's also about the triumph of the printed word or the written word or the printed word, let's say. And so they don't include other media in their epics. They discuss them and they incorporate them, but they're always transformed into the written word. Whereas Kluge doesn't. He allows the different media, or he puts a lot of visual media into his stories and allows each kind of component to stand on its own. And I think there are different reasons for that. Kluge, of course, also worked extensively as a filmmaker in West Germany. He's done a lot of different video works, and I think he really wants to highlight that the importance of the different ways of accessing reality, right? And so each medium will have a different kind of approach to reality, and in the innovative realism that I'm ascribing to the modern epic's work, each mode, let's say, is important on its own. And Kluge is keen on highlighting the plurality or the diversity, let's say, of media, and incorporates them, different media, into his storytelling in order to show how diversified literature itself can and must become. And this is something, of course, that remains important under conditions of full-blown digitalization too. So one can imagine that future permutations of the modern epic would become increasingly digital.
Did he have any resistance to all the sort of like embracing this sort of, I guess, for lack of a better word, like this technology? Or did he just see it as another vehicle to, I guess what I'm maybe asking, was he concerned with the number of people who were going to look at see his work? And was he trying to get it, you know, make it maybe more accessible, or?
Yes. Yeah. That's a great question. That's a great question. Because one thing that I argue is that Weiss and Janssen's books are very long, and it could be said hard to read, hard to get into, although, of course, I think they're totally worth getting into. In a way, Janssen's becomes a little bit easier to get into simply by the fact that he has one entry, one chapter, if you will, for each day of the year. So you have 365 or six chapters. You can kind of take them. Each chapter can be taken on its own, although, of course, they also add up into this larger story. With Kluge, the modern epic changes. And that's one of the important parts of my book, is to show that the modern epic changes into an assembly of stories that are many of which are interrelated, but they no longer congeal into any single main overarching storyline in the way the other two books do. And so part of what he does, and many of his individual stories are super short, and he wanted them to be short. You can read a Kluge story in a short amount of time. And he thought that this itself was a way of kind of democratizing, if you will, access to the epic imagination. That is not to say that, I mean, it's interesting, of course, to find, and which I try to show also in my chapter about Kluge, that even the shortest Kluge story is super complex. So you can spend a long time on a short story. But his work in different media is also a way of increasing access to the creative imagination. And so I think it's fair to say that all of his efforts in kind of this ecumenical outreach, if you will, to put his creativity and imaginative work out there in all kinds of different formats is a way of increasing access. The other thing, though, is that Kluge has himself said that writing is really writing. He likes to write most of all, and writing is really his main medium. And so it's interesting that starting with The Chronicle of Feelings, which was published in 2000, that inaugurated a series of these epically structured works that are all very large individual tomes, let's say, where he assembles his stories. And so it's for that reason, I feel it's warranted to discuss Kluge's literary output in terms of a permutation, but also a continuation of the modern epic genre.
Yeah. Can you give the listeners a sense as to just generally how prolific these three individuals were?
Yeah, that's the first question I got when I told people the kind of book I was writing. They said, "Oh my God, how do you have time to do that?" because they're really just long. The Aesthetics of Resistance is about 1,200 pages long. It comes atop Weiss's writing of a number of different plays. I'm not sure exactly how many, maybe more than half a dozen, I'm sure. Janssen wrote several novels. Janssen is one who wrote only in prose, or primarily in prose, I should say. He wrote several novels prior to embarking on this anniversaries project, which clocks in about 1,900 pages in the German. And then Kluge's Chronicle of Feelings is itself 2,000 pages long. After that, he has published. It's really remarkable. I don't know how he does it. Part it probably involves not sleeping very much. He's continued to put books out, assemblies of stories that are hundreds and hundreds of pages each. And so it's really quite remarkable. And there are probably not many people in the world who have read all of Kluge's works. I certainly haven't, but I feel like it's super fun to get into them. And the way he constructs his books enables readers to get into them at any point. It's just so interesting. And you can just kind of rummage around in them. And so, so like the other two books, they become very fun books to kind of live with, so to speak, and to reach for, even in random ways, where you can kind of reside in these books for a while, and take things out of them back into your everyday life, which each author would have appreciated. Kluge said, you know, the first thing he says in Chronicle of Feelings is like, look, we people need orientation in their lives. And I want to, and my storytelling is not just for its own sake, but also to provide people with orientation in their lives, a sense that they're not alone, a kind of parallel world in which they reside for a while, but also helps them reestablish relationships with people in their own world. And so the fact that this kind of literature really deals with this with interpersonality and front and center in such endearing and suggestive ways has really been something that that I think lingers on as a kind of legacy out of this storytelling.
Yeah, and so definitely all three of them have a sense, though, of what they're doing with these major works, right?
Oh, yeah.
they know going in. But I thank you for highlighting just how prolific these three are. They all wrote a lot.
Yes.
Yeah. They all wrote a lot.
They could not do otherwise. I think that was it was their way of living, right? Their way of living. And, you know, somewhere Janssen says, it's White Weiss who says, I'm holding myself upright by crafting this novel, right? And so what I write there becomes true for me and part of my world. And it's so fascinating that in doing so, he outfitted the world that he narrates there. He outfitted our world in such a way as that it can be turned into our own, to be turned into something that's more home-like, because we find we have a place therein, which is super interesting in terms of the aesthetics of resistance, because he starts from a position, his characters are marginalized proletarian working class folks who don't have immediate access. And he shows how they can aspire to gain access, and how they turn the world into something that they can call their own is a really aspirational kind of tale.
Just a more basic question. Did any of the three of them ever aspire to be, or were asked or guest lectured? Were any of them ever worked at a university?
Yes and no. So they were invited, both Janssen and Kluge were invited to give lectures as kind of poetic lectures, or there's a series in Frankfurt, I think they were, where they were invited as guest writers, essentially, to deliver lectures about their craft. And so in that sense, they worked at universities, but none of them are academics in a usual sense. And I think that there's something to be said for that the modern epic of this kind would not only could it not emerge from within the middle of the German nation, which doesn't exist in any straightforward way, during the Cold War, it would have to come from the margins, from outside of Germany, let's say, in a literal sense, in Weiss and Janssen's case. But it could also not come from within German academia and in any kind of straightforward way. So I think it's more imaginative and creative for not being, let's say, bogged down with the ins and outs of academic institutions, which is part of might afflict some of us.
Sure. Yeah. And German academics at the time were notoriously conservative. And so I was going to ask you to sort of make the broader case for why these individuals should be studied and why this should be and something that people study, which I think you've been doing effectively over the last, 55 minutes or so. But is there anything else that you would sort of, what is the future then of studying that these authors, the epic as a topic? I mean, where would you go next if you were?
No, it's a good question. And I'll maybe take the occasion to highlight maybe as clearly as possible, the value of this kind of study. I think, I highlighted 1945 and also 1968 and even 1989, the end of German division was also a kind of caesura of a passage from one age into another. And that's something that Kluge, who's the only one of the three to live through, he's still living now, the transition, 1989, 1990, lived through that time also as a caesura. And it was hard, in anticipating this interview, it was hard not to think of our current predicament with the COVID-19 threat as a kind of caesura, right? Where we think about our lives before and now during and hopefully one day after the threat of the virus. And I think I mentioned that because not only because a lot of us are confined to our homes and, may have time to read some of the things that escape us when going about other forms of living. But I mention it because the epic is really about a response to a need to kind of reset and to take greater and broader stock of where we are, how we got here, where we might be going. And so it's this kind of training in a long-term imagination and thinking in a long durée that the epic really contributes to. And one of the things I highlighted in the book throughout is that epic actually develops our senses. We have, in a basic way, we each have five senses, right? But we also have senses for what is near And what is far in terms of a historical sense, and in terms of trying to imagine other life contexts which we don't experience directly. And I think that the development of the human sensorium by way of the epic imagination has always been important, but maybe becomes even more so now when we find ourselves in a situation of confinement and fear about what the future may bring, or rather the problem is we're not even quite sure what the future will look like at all. And I think that taking a step back from the present and spending time in epic thinking, let's say, can be of great value. The other thing, given the difficulty of the works, you know, it was my, I don't do this so much in the US, but because I try to read the works in German, but when I have had the opportunity to spend time in German-speaking Europe, I gained a lot by trying to read the works together as part of reading groups and with other people as part of a kind of public practice. And obviously right now our public sphere is very much hindered by the situation in which we find ourselves, and which maybe has draws our attention to like the compels us to think about, okay, what connects me to others, and how do I communicate with others? How do I continue to share a world with others? What kind of projects can I pursue with other people, such that maybe even trying to read things together with others, whether on the internet or via these digital communications technologies and whatnot, whether that might have a new kind of value, and in restoring something of the epic sense, might by way of these works or others, it doesn't have to be these, we might be able to even get a handle on our situation in ways that might otherwise fail us when we're too inundated with the news cycle of the of a 24-hour period.
As a way to conclude discussion of your book, I always like to ask authors to give us one or two things that you would really like somebody who picks up your book and reads it to take away from it.
Yes, I think what I was saying about the literature's ability to extend, to contribute to and extend and develop our sense capacities, I think is something that I would want people to take away too. For people to appreciate how literature contributes to our imaginative and perceptive faculties, I think is something super interesting and super important, right? I mean, there's a lot of debates, right? And I'll link it back to the present again. Concerns about whether, for example, the United States right now is capable of responding to the threat of the coronavirus effectively, right? The discussions and controversies about the extent to which we live in a failed state or a failed society and so on, I think are super frightening, right? And I think we are all frightened with justification. And there are many things that have to be done in the face of that fear and the threats that we face. But one thing that we all need also is a kind of consolation that literature can provide, even provide by authors who themselves lost their homes, right? Lost their countries, let's say, and were forced to adapt to completely unprecedented situations and come out telling these very unlikely tales. You know, in 1945, in the immediate aftermath of World War II and the Holocaust, the caesura was discussed in such a way that people thought it would not be possible to say anything at all. Or to say anything at all, most especially to craft literature about the situation, would be something of a sacrilege or a disservice or whatnot. As on the other hand, one had to process what had just happened and what the challenges of the present entailed. And I think that literature has a lot to contribute, in other words, to this kind of predicament. And so that's what I would like to encourage readers to do, is to take up some of these works, which, you know, the second volume of The Aesthetics of Resistance by Weiss has just been translated, also very admirable translation available in English, which is interesting to explore.
So are all the main texts now that you use in this book available in English?
As I say, Anniversaries has been translated in its entirety. The first two volumes of Weiss's three-volume Aesthetics of Resistance have been translated, and parts of Kluge have been translated, not the whole, not cover to cover, but some of the chapters and story complexes, such as the air raid story that I mentioned, have appeared in English.
Okay, great. Yeah, just for those looking for it in English, helpful to know right up front. Before I let you go, now that this book is done, if you could probably tell us what you're working on now.
Sure. I mean, I currently have two main longer term projects, each of which has different parts. And one of them relates back to your question as the question, well, where does Epic go from here? And at the end of the book, I point to other works that I would put into this tradition. And there are many other authors one could talk about from the German context. But one of the things I want to do is kind of develop further what I call, somewhere in the book, I talk about the hydropoetics of Epic, and the notion that, and this, I try to evoke this by the cover of the book, which is a painting by the American-German painter Leonhard Feininger, the blue marine, which he painted at the Baltic. And I highlight some of the ways in the book, I highlight how the epic interacts with aquatic environments, right? So the seas and the rivers and so on are important to the storytelling. And so I envision a broader project called Hydropoetics for the Rising Waters of a Sinking Age, where I would address a broader array of works in Germanophone and European literature from the 20th and 21st centuries to continue to track the kinds of things that the modern epic can do, how it makes or remakes the world, how it interacts with the elements, and maybe contribute in exploring that, maybe contribute something to the environmental imagination. It's something I've kind of been toying with for a while now, with this kind of hydrocentric remapping of European culture. So what I mean by that is that I've adopted a kind of focus on the continent's watersheds to avoid speaking about different nations, but rather talking about the different sites, often river sites like the Danube and the Rhine, as sites that are multicultural and that bring kind of different languages and cultures together that are interesting to explore in that way. The project that I'm working on right now, though, in a most immediate way, is about literature and politics in the First Austrian Republic. So from 1919 to 1934, it's a super interesting period and constellation between the Austrian Social Democratic Party, which has power in Vienna. And so one speaks of a red Vienna that is governed by the Social Democrats, that kind of launches a super fascinating period of democratic emancipation, urban modernization, and so on, and that unfortunately gets shut down and prematurely aborted, really, by the rise of fascism in Austria in the 1930s. Also, so I'm looking at the literature and politics of the interwar period in Vienna and Austria to explore a kind of Austrian variant of the dialectic between political modernity and literary modernism that's specific to the site, but also kind of exemplary value. Also because it's the last place of democratic resistance to fascism prior to the Spanish Civil War. And so in that way, it kind of is the pre-chapter to where Weiss begins his epic.
Well, I won't put any pressure on you, but when you're done with these projects and their books, I would love to have you back on the show to talk about them.
It would be my pleasure.
And I definitely want to thank you again for coming on the show and talking to us about your book. And congratulations on it being out and out for sale. And I would highly recommend everybody listening go out and get it. Get it ebook right now. Don't go out.
Right.
I want to thank Dr. Miller for being on the show. The book title, again, is The German Epic in the Cold War. It was published by Northeastern University Press. Thank you all for listening, and we will see you all next time.